any review of history shows that humans will do whatever they need to. And it's our job as a species that's intelligent to design a society that actually brings the best out of us. We're not perfect, but brings the best out of us and limits systematically and logically all the things that create the worst tendencies, the old lower reptilian reactions. And again, as I will speak of with this lecture, virtually every element of the socioeconomic system we have today supports the opposite of what we technically and intuitively define as sustainable and humane. And a core consequence here is the class division, which says this group of people is more deserving for a high quality of life, the right to life, while this group of people can just naturally suffer and die. And that's that. That's just the way the system is. And as bad as that is on the surface, given history, you can see the natural evolution of it and the sort of socially Darwinistic assumption of all the scarcity. But what we have today, which makes this even more enraging, is the fact that we can produce an abundance, that we can utilize our technology and make sure everyone has their basic needs met for this population and population many times over when you put it all together. And that's, of course, again, what the Zeitgeist Movement helps to promote, which is why the work of Jacques Fresco and Buckminster Fuller and the philosophies of Carl Sagan, Nikola Tesla, and many other prominent thinkers always run concurrent with this because, well, we don't have to live this way. And the more this system continues, the more division will be created because it's inherent to it, and the faster this system collapses and causes severe injury. And in the course of this collapse, however, we hope that the movement can do something viable and relevant to ease the stress and make a movement, again, no pun intended, to a new social system, one based on fundamental, rational, updated knowledge. And, you know, in the midst of all of this, in the awakening that's happening across the world, we have a lot of terms being thrown around, resource-based economy, post-scarcity, and a lot of structural design issues that kind of seem novel, and for those that aren't really digging deep enough, they start to identify with institutional relationships or concepts in a framed way. But really, what are we talking about? We're simply talking about basic logical reasoning about what's possible and where we are with the state of knowledge today. And the social system construct, if your goal is to keep humanity sane and peaceful and with a fortitude of abundance and all the basic logical things that we intuitively know create social stability, the social system concept becomes a running development of what the most efficient means to create social stability is. So, not to harp on that tangent, but I do think it's important for people to begin to understand that we're dealing with propositional-based logic, cross-verification of ideas as the scientific development continues, the scientific method, and the propositional logic that's developed here, the inference that's there, the implications that start to connect things as far as what works and what doesn't, transcends every known element of institution. You can get rid of the name of Zeitgeist Movement. You can get rid of any concept of design. These are all X, Y's, and Z's, if you will, if you've ever studied formal logic. It's irrelevant. It's the train of thought that's important here, and I can't reiterate that enough. To me, I'm beginning to not even use the term resource-based economy in explanation because it gets in the way. It gets in the way just like saying, oh, Peter Joseph said this gets in the way. Don't talk like that. Don't ever reference an institution or a person. If you can speak in the logical train of thought, you will win many people over. People don't want to identify with others and institutions. You have to get them to realize it for themselves so they identify with themselves. And the illusion that their novelty has created this in their own value shift will be the reinforcer that sticks, if that makes sense. Otherwise, you're going to run into ego problems. In fact, since I'm on that subject, I wanted to read a quick section on logic and psychology, which is from a book called An Introduction to Logic and the Scientific Method by Cohen and Nagel. And basically, they do a really good job of making some statements with respect to the point I've just made. You know, logic is not the same as psychology. I want to just read a few excerpts of this for those that have never actually thought about this issue. Quote, "The logical distinction between valid and invalid inference does not refer to the way we think, the process going on in someone's mind. The weight of evidence is not itself a temporal event, but a relation of implication between certain classes or types of propositions. Similarly, our apprehension of the logical implication on which our inferences are based may be studied as a psychological event, but the relation directly apprehended is not itself a psychological event at all. It is a relation between the forms of propositions and indirectly one between the classes of possible objects asserted by them. The realization that logic cannot be restricted to psychological phenomenon will help us to discriminate between our science and rhetoric, conceiving the latter as the art of persuasion or of arguing so as to produce the feeling of certainty. But such feeling of certainty may exist apart from all logic, and the factual persuasiveness of arguments is more often brought about by properly chosen words, which through association have powerful emotional influences than through logically assailable arguments. Our emotional dispositions make it very difficult for us to accept certain propositions, no matter how strong the evidence in their favor. And since all proof depends upon the acceptance of certain propositions as true, no proposition can be proved to be true to one who is sufficiently determined not to believe it. I'll stop there, unquote. You know, it's a really amazingly profound point when you realize that the foundation of what we're talking about transcends any individual person, any individual institution, or any individual concept of design. There's a logical unfolding that needs to be understood, and in reality, the entire human species needs to begin to understand this fundamental train of thought and align their values, and then boom, you might have what you could call a true civilization. It's finding that common ground in a process of reasoning that really cannot be transcended. Okay, enough of all that rambling. However, before I jump into the lecture, I do want to comment on 2011 and what we can think about for 2012, since this is again the last radio show of the year. 2011 has been an amazing year for the maturity of the movement, for certain developments, for the refining of processes, for the realization of those who really understand this, who get it, who have the independence required. For me personally, it's been the year of burnout. From the release of Moving Forward in January, I went on a long, deep burnout and near depression because of the outrageous amount of labor that went forward. We saw the Venus Project debacle emerge, which set really a new definition of the movement in many ways and brought really what this movement is to the forefront, which is actually a good thing in the end, I've come to realize, as contentious as all of that is. I really think that the presentation of the movement as a group of people pushing forward with a train of thought as opposed to an institution is a very, very effective place to be. The greatest traps, again, out there are the associations with figures or institutions, and it doesn't take any particular entity or guru to tell you what to think. The process of thought is independent. It's simply a matter of collecting information, as noted before, and assessing it properly, as objectively as humanly possible, based on your cultural victimization. Regardless, 2011 has brought a lot of great developments, from the new website to the amazing blog site, and big thanks to Federico and Brandy and Danette and everyone else that have been working on that. We have a lot of new developments across the world as far as how things are being engaged, as far as ideas. The town halls became nice and consistent. The media festival was a great success across the world. We have Zeitgeist Day coming up in March, which I hope everyone is preparing for. We'll have meetings on that very soon. It's been a very unique year, and I think 2012, superstition aside, is going to set the stage for a lot of other developments. One thing I think is worth commenting on is the Global Redesign Institute and what this means, and the technical approach to the redesign of a region, and then public display of that to show people that there's a new solution. We talk about transition a lot, and I really think that people are going to get behind a new social system when they see the technical relationships of the system in a very discreet way. So you could have a Los Angeles redesign team where they take on certain infrastructure issues, forget the concept of money, and then redesign it logically based on where resources are, based on what the necessity is, based on what sustainability demands, peak efficiency, and all of the attributes that we've talked about in the materials. And you present a logical blueprint of what a new social design would be from an infrastructure standpoint, physically, energy, transportation, all of that. And you cater it to the region specifically. And if you can show the public that, if you can get press for that, then you might see a rational transition emerge. I've talked about sort of a parallel government system. Well, what would that parallel government be? A bunch of bureaucrats sitting around? No, be a series of technicians and thinkers that want to apply technical means to society. And jumping ahead here, imagine if you had a region that saw such blueprints and they said, you know what, we're going to do this. Forget money, we're going to conscript the resources. Let's assume they have the resources in their region. They get agreement from the population to do so, and they begin to reconstruct their society in the most efficient way. And hopefully, in this very loose generalization I'm speaking of, the concept would catch on. If people in a region that's extremely impoverished because of larger order economic forces don't want to deal with it anymore, and they know from a technical perspective they can create an environment where there's free food, free energy, the entire population is taken care of at its basic level, even though they're within the walls of the market system, I think eventually it's going to happen. Will there be great discord? Yes, there will. But there's no way the transition to any new social concept will not have great discord on many levels, because really you're dealing with a powerful evolution of values in such an idea. But again, showing the technical reality is probably the most efficient if you can get people to clearly understand it and see the flaws of this system simultaneously. And of course, that leads us to the breakdown, speaking again of 2011. Come 2012, with the debt crisis, the unemployment crisis, the energy crisis, oil is now inching back up again, the inflationary issues, if these bailouts continue, there is a witch's brew of elements here that have really yet to blow up as far as my analysis is concerned. And again, prophecy aside, 2012 has all the earmarks of being a very, very complex and destabilized year, which means we have to be that much more vigilant in the communication, because destabilization leads to change. You know, one thing I am going to talk about as I get into lecture, the NPAA and the SOPA, the new legislations against the internet, and national security nonsense, extensions of the Patriot Act that are protective measures coming from the state in the United States, which really, and whether conscious or not, frankly, sees how threatened they really are, sees how destabilized things are becoming. And what do you do if you're trying to protect? Well, you make laws to inhibit people's freedom and inhibit the freedom of communication. Age-old tactic. The last thing they want is unity, so the internet, of course, is one of the biggest fears. And I'm going to touch upon those as I get into the talk. But overall, I just wanted to make a quick comment on that. And I think 2012 is going to be catalytic. It's going to be probably a turning point on a few different levels with respect to the way people see society and what they find important. And finally, at a personal note, I will have Zeitgeist Beyond the Pale probably released by the end of 2012. That's my goal. And I'm also intending to do a series in the meantime, maybe 20, 25-minute blocks, which would be considered a web series, which maybe will occur an episode a month, in a very different gesture that will take place in a live-action setting regarding cultural absurdities and almost have a humor component to it. It won't have the name Zeitgeist. It will have a completely different name and be a very, very different approach to more or less the same ideas, however, in the hope of gaining a wider demographic, basically speaking a different type of language that others will find entertaining that's very different in style from the Zeitgeist film series or the like. So that's something else I'm working on. So I have a lot planned between the Global Redesign Institute and these two projects, not to mention the refinement of lectures and everything else. We have all sorts of updates coming soon. And for those that are interested, the end of next month I will be speaking at Columbia University with the Artivist Film Festival. They'll be showing Zeitgeist moving forward. And then in February, early February, I'll be speaking in Israel at a Z Fest, kind of global peace arrangement that they're doing with the Zeitgeist Movement Israel. I'm looking forward to that. Some might remember I was going to go in December for this project Peace on Earth, but I had to pull out of that due to schedule problems and some organizational issues on their end. But their concert looked like it went pretty well. I did some visual contributions for that. And then, of course, in March we have Zeitgeist Day in Vancouver, which should be very, very, very good. They've been doing great work on that, a big three-day event, which I'm trying to get the updated data for, by the way. So as soon as I have that, an email will be sent out. And anyone that wants to attend that should have the ability to do so as far as arrangement. But we know people like to plan in advance. So that's that, and let's go into structural classes in lecture number 6. Oh, and by the way, you might note, those that paid attention, that lecture number 6 was called something else regarding values. I realized that that subject matter, as I had written it, had basically already been covered in prior lectures, so I'm skipping that one. So we're moving ahead 1, structural classes in lecture number 6. So what is social class? Social class is usually referred to in an economic sense, but it could also have a cultural component to it too. And basically, it's an arrangement of people in a society from top to bottom, abstractly speaking. And at the lower rungs, there are the less deserving or less skilled, and at the higher rungs, there are the most deserving or most skilled, at least as far as the theory goes. It's a reward-based stratification with the assumption that the place someone finds themselves is somehow inherent to their quality when it comes to their contribution to society, generally speaking. As a brief aside, it's intuitive to think that those that contribute the most to society are given the most reward, hence your incentive system. But that's actually not the case because of what the actual method of attainment of income actually entails, which is differential advantage and abuse and exploitation. Therefore, that kind of fantasy utopian notion holds absolutely no validity. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I would like to point out, if you look at pay scales across, especially the United States, those that make the most money are in the positions of least contribution across the board. And that's something I think everyone should keep in mind as we go through the structural elements of this system and psychological, that the very premise of the reward system based on class is intrinsically faulty and does not subscribe to the idea that those who work the hardest are actually the most rewarded. However, if you look at primates in general, class relationships are very much there. Stratification of, say, baboons is very apparent, very solid, very consistent. Not all primates have class, but it's extremely common, and this has been used as a human nature argument for a long time. And I think it's probably valid to say that given certain scarcity implications, survival of the fittest, so to speak, does come to fruition in the Darwinian sense, and those that are the biggest and strongest will have more power to preserve resources for themselves over someone who's more enfeebled. That is fundamental, I think. But that doesn't mean that human society is stuck in that pattern. If you remember that we can think and we can adjust ourselves and diminish certain lower brain reactions if we choose to be conscious of them, we can be rational in how we approach things, then the class association through the genetic implication, it becomes nominal and almost irrelevant because of really how much control we really do have. And when the larger order realization comes into play, that we are indeed social, and we have to have a social sense of relationship, that our personal interest must become social interest for our long-term evolutionary fitness, then it becomes even more apparent that our logic can prevail, and we can create a system without economic class, which would gain more stability in public health, which I'll go into in a moment. But the point I want to make here as well is that class is not explicit to money and resources. You can have stratification of many different things. You can have the abilities of some amazing skill. Excuse me. You can have an amazing skill that someone else has not perfected. And in its own right, that is a class relationship. When you go to a dentist, you're not a dentist. You might know something about basic dental care. You might not be an expert like they are. Therefore, there is a class relationship to that as too. There is a stratification of knowledge and place. And to me, this represents a larger order of the group mind. It's an assessment of different skill sets and how we are indeed social. And certain specialized attributes are natural to the condition. Therefore, equality, as it were, is actually impossible in the broadest possible theoretical way. People are not equal in the overtly utopian philosophical sense. However, economic equality, resource equality, is a different matter. And meeting the needs of the human population, needs that almost universally everyone share, is a fundamental element of living and public health. And this is what separates the class argument that the Zeitgeist movement puts forward versus many other class arguments you see with, say, Marxism. And this basically brings us back to the logical denotation that was made earlier, logic versus psychology, values versus rigor of thought and scientific integrity. The issue is public health. Is there evidence to show that the class relationships we have today are good for public health and our evolutionary fitness, or are they detracting? Are they bad? Do they cause sickness? Do they cause mental disorders, heart disease, and all the factors that we've come to learn? That brings me, of course, to the work of Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. I strongly recommend their work, and you know, you really need to look at their sources too, because it's based on vast sociological studies over long periods of time to show that no, it's a myth. You know, if you were to go to really impoverished areas that didn't know they were impoverished, but they had their necessities, they were maybe agrarian, they didn't have the TV and the stereo blaring, they didn't have the iPod and the iPad, they didn't have all these toy amenities that are really rather superficial, convenient, superficial, and have a very vanity orientation in the culture as far as status, they're very happy people. It seems like people can be extremely happy with what we might consider a very minimalistic form of living. They're living in what they've come to understand, and happiness is not contingent upon their property. It's not contingent upon comparison. So in a world that's covered in media now, in a world where you have mass division and people with massive mansions and jets parked in their front lawn versus the innumerable amount of people that have, quote, nothing in comparison, a psychological distortion, the psychosocial stress comes to fruition. And people begin to think that their value is less, that other people are gaining more than them for whatever purpose, that they're less of a human being, and then hence the neuroses continues. And that neuroses, of course, is reinforced by advertising and other mechanisms. Now, those broad issues aside, let's think about how this system evolved. The class relationship and imbalance we see today, which has sparked the Occupy uprisings and many other uprisings across the world, stretching into the political sphere, which usually those grievances are always based economically. I always want to remind people about that. If you were to ask somebody what they object to in politics, their reasoning will always come down to some sort of economic imbalance, almost universally. Excuse me. The class phenomenon we have today is basically an outgrowth of a very primitive tribalism, needless to say, with the assumption of scarcity and not enough to go around. That is the basis of the kind of paradox within the economic market theory. One side of the economic theory says there's not enough to go around, as Adam Smith denoted, that the death of, you know, the poverty-stricken children was a natural consequence. In the Bible, the rhetoric is there will always be the poor among you. These associations have been there for a long time with the assumption of scarcity. And of course, the paradox of the market system, which is based on growth, of course, assumes infinite resources simultaneously, but I'm not going to go on that tangent. My point here is that the assumption of scarcity has permeated the mechanics of society, and therefore built into it is the need for a strategic edge to gain advantage over other human beings so one group can prosper, in the same logic as two people fighting over one piece of meat in the middle of a cave, if you want to use that analogy. And what's happened, and this leads me to the subject of structural classism, is that it's not just the temporal behavior of people that's corrupt. Those that have formed this system, which have been operating with those values, have tailored the system, whether you know, consciously or not, to make sure it benefits them or their constituency, if you will, at the highest level of advantage. And there's no greater advantage you can have than a system which benefits you while the players of the game don't know that. They don't know that the system is intrinsically there to better one class over another. And that is where we are today and what I want to talk about for the remainder of this lecture. In fact, I'll say this, there is no greater scam than the concept of the free market when it comes to strategic advantage. I find it almost hilarious that the great majority of the population believes that this freedom-oriented system is really the enabler of those that already have advantage to exploit their freedom. It's the freedom for the tyranny that we see on a daily basis. It's void of all scientific rationale, logical distribution of resources, and all the things we talk about in the movement. It is a psychological con job in operation. I'm not being conspiratorial here. This is just the way the advantage perspective works, which is of course rewarded in the system, broadly speaking, which has the illusion that the playing field is balanced. It has the illusion that it's based on the merit of the individual and all those things, when it's deeply, deeply skewed. And for those of you out there that still promote the utopian free market fantasy, and that all these other things are state impositions that restrict the beauty of the free market, it is extremely naive to assume that a system that's based on competition and differential advantage could not gravitate towards larger order corruption. Corruption in this case defined by those who are seeking advantage through structural means. There are no rules to war, and the free market is a war system. So what is structural classism? Structural classism are the components of the socioeconomic system that guarantee imbalance, guarantee oppression, guarantee draconian legislation, which I'll talk about a little bit later as I talk about the SOPA, the NDAA, etc. It is a natural outgrowth of the need to gain advantage over your environment and hence over other people, continuing the tribalistic tradition we see. And the most scary attribute of all this is that the more the system fails, the more the destabilization occurs, the more problems that arise, the more compounded these protective and dominant and totalitarian measures will materialize. It works really against transitional ideas in a certain sense, which is why broad change of world perspective has to emerge, which is why it's so critically important that the ideas of access abundance, post-scarcity, the recognition that we can create an abundance to meet the needs of the human population at a very high level. As an aside, let's remember there's always scarcity. It's a rational disposition, an organized form of thought that says, okay, yeah, it's a little bit violent for me to want excessive amounts over somebody else. Why? Because it's impossible for all of that to go around, therefore it's an unsustainable concept and can only lead to conflict. In fact, I would say it's an issue of social maturity. And as will be alluded to as I bring up these points, the free market model of socioeconomic paradigm, the monetary market system, really is a strategic form of violence. The imbalance and the mere generation of poverty in and of itself that isn't necessary really is violent. It is a structurally violent system. The first component I want to talk about, which of course I've talked about before, but we're going to be organized here, is the use of debt. For those that are not familiar, money is created out of debt. Debt is an imposition. Basically, every single dollar produced assumes that some form of energy or labor is going to represent that dollar. And the punchline of the whole thing is that the debt becomes displaced. The responsibility of that debt is displaced. In other words, if I have $20,000 in a bank account, but I have myself no debt, no student loan debt, no credit card debt, I'm debt-free, somebody else is responsible, liable, for the $20,000 that you have. Think about that. And as the iteration of the economy works out, it's very obvious to see how the debt becomes displaced and moved down the socioeconomic ladder to the poor, or in effect generating the poor. Now, why is it that that occurs? Well, it has to do with income inequity, which is based largely on investment or the use or acquisition of interest. Interest, which will be component two here, I'll talk about investment more so in a second, is a double-edged type of problem. On one side, the interest system punishes those that cannot afford outright to buy common social amenities such as a house or a car. So if you're poor, well, excuse me, if you're middle class or even upper middle class in many cases, you don't have cash on hand to buy a $150,000 home. You have to take a loan from a bank and pay exorbitant amounts of interest on it. Usually at the end of the term, it's like sometimes 60-70% of the principal, which is just insane. You are paying. You are being penalized because you need that loan. You don't have the money up front. However, on the other side, if you're wealthy, you can invest in a CD or a number of other instruments, in mere accounts that just give you interest for that deposit, and you make money with the interest. It becomes a part of your income. It reinforces your advantage, and it displaces, back to my prior point, the debt that is inherent in the system. abstractly speaking. So right there, of all the points to be discussed, that is crucial. The debt and interest system is an outgrowth of the market system. Keep that in mind. Money is treated as a commodity. The debt is treated as a commodity. And that debt is hence sold for the profit of the interest. The value of the money is the debt. It's explicit to it, if that makes sense. Yes, I know it makes no real sense in the theory of traditional free market value, but that's exactly what it implies. So, what does that create? That creates immediate imbalance because the interest is getting has a benefit on one side and has punishment on the other, self-reinforcing class division. And the most amazing thing about this is that it puts people in positions of servitude, both on a local level, meaning employment. You get out of college, you have $80,000 worth of debt, you are ripe to be essentially enslaved by whatever corporate institution sees that advantage. And it's a natural psychological element because you're imposed upon. You are in a position of imposed scarcity. Therefore, you are going to be less picky. You need income at all times because you're already in the red. That's one side. Then there's the use of debt to conquer and enslave whole countries, which was talked about in Zeitgeist Addendum. Another powerful, powerful element to consider. A lot of the horrendous poverty problems you see in Latin America, Ecuador, and all of these places has to do with IMF debt bailouts, as it were, which were nothing of the sort, and I'm not going to go on that issue, but it's used as a tool. It's a weapon. And in that context, you can begin to see the global stratification problem. You can begin to see how, just as banks have the ability and power to do this here locally in the United States, for example, these larger governing banking institutions have been given some erroneous power to make money out of nothing and to put whole countries in a position of servitude and liability. And, of course, when you realize that the interest does not exist in the money supply outright, the interest is on top of the principal, which basically means the creation of more money and more debt, which is loaned out at interest again. It's very easy to see how this imbalance occurs, the debt is displaced, and whole sectors of society are taken advantage of. In other words, it isn't just an anomaly of the system. It is actually just a mere matter of time before this structured opposition takes hold in some sector, whether nationally or internationally. Component three, investment. By its general nature, the idea of investing automatically denotes excess of income. Someone has to be in a fairly decent position to be able to invest any of their money in anything. So it's a rich man's game fundamentally. And there was a Forbes article that came out in November, if I remember. I think you could search this. It was something to the effect of the top one-tenth of the nation earn half of all capital gains. So not forget the top 1%, you're talking about the top one-tenth of America earns half of all capital gains. About 315,000 individuals out of 315 million are making half of all capital gains on the sale of shares of stock or property. And that is, according to Forbes, 60% of the income made by the Forbes 400. The top 400. Are there gains to be made in the field of investment? Obviously there are. But that gain is limited to a very, very small percentage of the population because of the lack of equity. In a country now where one out of two are basically in poverty, there's a very small fraction of people that actually have the risk factor, the risk flexibility to invest in the way that these guys do. And that is inherently structural. Therefore, it is another form of structural classism. And on that subject leads us to component four, which has to do with lobbying and legal legislation coming from the U.S. Congress or any country for that matter, and how the game is always to be more and more lenient on the financial liabilities of those of the upper class. I shouldn't have to express this too much. It's obviously on the tip of everyone's tongue. Probably one of the few things people like Warren Buffett and these wealthy people can ever comment on with any integrity, how they know they're not paying as many taxes, how they know you know, Bush reducing capital gains taxes continues to benefit the rich. However, it's utterly insane and naive to think that the government would not be subservient to the financial powers, because the financial interest itself is what controls everything. One thing I'd like to recommend to those that don't believe that, that think we're in a different paradigm than we ever were, in America or across the world, or throughout history, frankly, at least past 2,000 years, the history of empires, the history of the post-Neolithic world where this confusion and immaturity of society has led to so much grave imbalance and fear and power neuroses, is to see how it's been prior. If you go back and look at elections and debates long back in the United States, it's the same arguments over and over again. It should be a given at this point for us to understand where the gravitation of government, as it were, really lies. And it is absurd to believe that there's ever going to be legislation and benefit of those that need it, the poor, because it will systematically limit the true driver of the economy, which is the rich. We now live in America in a plutocracy, a plutonomy. There's so much money moving amongst the upper percentile that it makes the GDP fueling components of the lower class irrelevant. If you can see the lecture Social Pathology if you want more information on that, where that document by Citigroup is firmly outlined. And likewise, it's not only protectionist in the sense of taxation, in the sense of giving further breaks to this constituency that basically runs the U.S. government financially. It also inherently generates protective measures for the establishment basically being industry itself. And this will lead me to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011. As I commented in the description of this radio show, I wanted to make this point, but I'm putting it within the context of structural classism, because what else would we expect than the removal of civil liberties in a period where the system is showing itself for its grave imbalance, where the effects are so dramatic? What do you do to preserve yourself? You limit, legally, people's ability to fight back. Very quickly, the NDAA is an extension of the Patriot Act. It's an extension of the Military Tribunals Act. It's a broad attack on the American Bill of Rights. And, of course, this type of draconian legislation already exists in many other countries. U.S., because of its spoiled disposition and general balance, has been a little late to the game, but the chickens have been coming home to roost, so this should be very much expected by everybody. One thing that I don't think is rational are those that see this as a blind power kind of generation. You have this in sort of the more conspiratorial thing where it's a blind power control issue. Actually, it's a defense mechanism of the system. Using the guise of terrorism, there's a whole fundamental logic going on behind the scenes that says anything that threatens the establishment will be deemed terrorism. We're not talking about buildings blowing up or anything. We're talking about anyone that doesn't really like the way things are is now a terrorist. And the core section that I think is getting the most press is 1021, which basically says that the due process of law is no longer relevant in certain circumstances, and basically anyone can be taken in and imprisoned with no legal counsel. This also had elements in the Military Tribunals Act, too, where they'd strip your citizenship, if I remember correctly. So, it doesn't shock me. It's a great way to scare people, isn't it? Because, frankly, that's how I see these things. I don't see this as a response in any rational sense to any terrorist element, naturally. I see this as a way to incite fear in those of the community that might pay attention to it, those that might be a little bit more apprehensive to be activist-oriented. So to me, as an aside, I ignore it. I think if everyone ignored it, there's nothing that can be done. And I think that goes for most of the fear tactics coming from the United States government, or any government for that fact. That's an aside, though. In the end, the upheaval against this legislation is rightfully so, obviously, and it's good to see people coming out on larger levels to protest at the ACLU and everything else, and I certainly support that. But I also want to keep in mind what the causal mechanism here really is, and that it actually isn't that much different when it comes to the flexibility of power in this totalitarian sense that was started after 9/11. However, very quickly, a much greater concern to me is the SOPA, legislation, the Stop Online Privacy Act, which really is a response, as far as I'm concerned, to the Arab Spring that started through social networking, of course, Occupy Wall Street. It's very, very clear that this type of legislation and its power can easily thwart the ability of people to get together under basically pretenses that seem to be unrelated. Under the guise of copyright protection, essentially, it's giving law enforcement a much greater edge, an almost independent edge from what I've come to understand, to go after any site, shut down any site that seems to be in violation. And when you look at what the internet is with its syndication and the constant duplication of material and just the waves and waves of content that flows in and out, which really defines the beauty of it, it's very easy to pick and choose anything to find copyright violation. We could have the zeitgeistmovement.com, we could have a general image that was utilized, that's a stock image, someone could call that in or it could be seen independently, and the whole site could theoretically be shut down because of the use of that image, etc. That's possibly an extreme example, but it's not out of the question. And usually these types of legislations are stepping stones for larger order censorship and oppressive legislations, and you could easily see how the internet can turn into, well, what it is in China. So that denoted, I'm keeping my larger context here, because what does this really do? First of all, on the economic side, it's restrictive, and it really supports a system that's hell-bent on copyright protection, at least ostensibly. And on the other side, it's giving power to more or less regulate any troublemaking sites that wasn't there before, limiting free speech. And in a system that's suffering from mass failures, in a system where the internet is very powerful in communication, I find it illogical to assume that such government power could not be used for establishment preservation, meaning limitation of the internet during times of upheaval, such as what we saw with the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, and everything else. Something to keep in mind, I still consider it a reaction of the establishment to counter the growing awakening and dissatisfaction in the world today. And if I'm keeping track here, that was a component 5, legal legislation elements. And this brings me to the notion of federal offenses and the criminal system, the prison system, and the basic crime and punishment system with respect to structural classism. Now, I did an interview with James Gilligan, and unfortunately I can't remember the reference, but he writes about it in his book, actually, one of his books, regarding the Lyndon Johnson administration and how certain tactics were used to incarcerate African Americans back then to remove their rights so they couldn't vote. And this happens very much today with minorities. We see this with profiling. We also have the component of a felony, which is a very serious federal crime. And a felony means that you not only can't vote, you're pretty much not going to get a job. The age of computer technology has allowed for most people to be able to find out who's a felon and who isn't, and most jobs have access to these databases, or they can. And generally speaking, and especially in real life experience, my mother used to deal with people that were convicted of felonies. They had a tremendously difficult time. These are people that were not violent necessarily. They probably had drug offenses, which was pretty much a socioeconomic consequence of deprivation psychologically. And they're given a felony, and they're basically ruined for the rest of their life, existing in a permanent subclass with very little chance of ever gaining an occupation that could provide for them on a level that would increase their class relationship. This is a very serious thing and a very sick element of society when you are labeled as such. On a deeper level, it's interesting to point out that most felons would be highly victimized by the system. Felons existing in huge deprivations, either ones that most likely overall have been in periods of deprivation holistically in their upbringing, and they would also probably be the most outstanding critics of the system, depending on their education and understanding of what's actually happening. So it's quite interesting that the restriction of such a subclass is what it is, because it not only limits their ability to support themselves, it also limits their ability to denote change, hence through the kind of farce process of democracy as it exists, but nevertheless, that vote is removed. I believe there are like 5.5 million Americans now that are felons that can't vote and are in highly deprived positions. And we look at most drug offenses and who's actually in the prison population is one of the largest prison systems in the world, the United States, using the United States continually as an example. You see that there is really a systematic reaction of the system to limit the power of those that are going against the system. And I consider that to be a form of structural classism in the longest, long-term view. The seventh component I want to address is the idea of credit. Credit is fascinating. Credit is this universal ranking system based on how well you interact with money and loans, how you've paid your loans back, how much outstanding debt you have, given against some more or less arbitrary benchmark statistically. And if you injure your credit, you are systematically reduced in your access to loans and hence your ability to gain the necessities of life in certain cases, such as a loan for a house or a loan for a car or an application for something, etc. And obviously, the worse someone's credit, the worse their credit will likely become because their ability to access necessity is even more limited. If you don't have the credit to go out and buy a decent car and you have to save up and buy a really bad car, a bad car that needs repair and constant maintenance, you are at an inevitable disadvantage financially, which will continue to hurt you and continue to perpetuate your lower class status. I'm going to move more quickly here, moving on to point eight, and that is insurance. The insurance system, of course, is a business. The more ailments you have, the less likely you're going to get insurance, even with the supposed Obama situation. I don't have insurance, and I've been denied insurance a number of times because of a back issue, and I mean outright, not even given a moment, and I've been frustrated with it because in many ways insurance is a fraud on all sides, but I'm not going to go into that point. Insurance as it is systematically reinforces financial liability. Most bankruptcies are based on health insurance issues. So if you are in a position of disadvantage physically, you're automatically in a position of disadvantage for your financial support, and boom, you have more necessities than the average person, yet you're more restricted because of your pre-existing condition. That naturally generates inherent class placement. And again, this is the market system at work. This is the logic of advantage and profit and self-preservation. So don't think that this is an anomaly. Don't think that all the insurance, health insurance companies are just corrupt in some moral sense. No. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do to keep everyone employed in their sector. And I just realized I skipped number six, I think, which is the corporate profit pyramid. Okay, I don't remember if I did that or not, but I don't remember if I had stated the numbers correctly, in other words. But number six out of eight is the corporate pyramid structure, and basically the CEO to worker pay imbalance. As of 2005, the average CEO in the United States earned 262 times the pay of the average worker. And the imbalance continues to grow. It's ridiculous, the difference in scale of pay. The more this pyramid is constructed, the more someone flies up from CEO to board of directors, to managerial positions, and all the way down, there's a multiplier that is absolutely out of whack and naturally is a class perpetuating element. And here is where the greed psychology and the commonality of this approach is so absurd, because the cost cutting that happens with these institutions are so neurotic, so mentally distorted and out of whack, that they're willing to kill jobs even though they're making salaries so exorbitant that they could probably keep a great number of workers if their incentive was not to maximize profits at all time, which is the ultimate rule. That's what you do for your stockholders. That's what the value of your corporation is. So it's basically inherent to the system. If you're going to maximize profits for the corporation as a whole on paper, why not maximize profits for yourself? So I'm going to stop there because I'm tired. I could probably come up with a number of more issues that are inherent to the system and expand on the psychology, of course, of the differential advantage and how that fuels into a lot of these mechanisms. But we've covered debt, we've covered interest, we've covered investment, we've covered lobbying, we've covered the legal system, the oppression of those that are in violation of this system. We've covered the corporate pyramid, we've covered credit, we've covered insurance. That should be enough to give people a sense of how this system reinforces class division, and that's just in this particular context. You know, we're not even talking about global debt collapse and all the other mechanisms. So I want to leave it at that, and I appreciate everybody listening to this, and I hope it wasn't too rambly, and I will talk to everyone soon.